From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Brian Kemp will be sworn in today as the 83rd governor of Georgia. It is also the first day of the legislative session. The Georgia General Assembly now has 40 days to pass new legislation and shape the future of our state. GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler and Political Rewind host Bill Nygut are here to share their institutional knowledge and insights on a critical day in Georgia politics. Thanks for being here so much.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, thanks. Bill, I'm going to start with you and the inauguration. You've covered many an election and many an inauguration day in Georgia. So tell us about the pomp and circumstance that's going to end with Brian Kemp as Georgia's highest official.
The first thing is that I have talked to any number of legislators and others who are going to be part of this inauguration, either just as spectators or perhaps have some role in the program. And the first thing they all say is, thank goodness we're going to be indoors, because there was a time when Georgia governors were inaugurated on the front steps of the state capitol. And a couple of cases that I can think of, one particularly, I was trying to think as we started this conversation, was it Sonny Perdue, who in his first term, maybe one of your listeners will remind me of this, actually had to move it indoors because the weather was so brutally cold out. So number one, we're going to be at Georgia Tech. It'll be dry and it'll be warm. That's the first and most important thing many people are talking
besides
about.
Besides the weather, is it always a kind of similar ceremony, or will Kemp leave his mark on this, doing something unique?
I don't think the role of the governor-elect on Inauguration Day is to do something unique. I think, yes, it's a formality, it's a ceremony that confers upon the new governor the levers of power of the state. And I think his job will be to quite simply give a message that tells us something about what his vision for the future of Georgia is, and perhaps to inspire us that there's a better future awaiting us out there. And I think more than anything else, that's the marker you lay down. Here's what I see as our vision for who we can be and how I hope to get us there.
Especially after a very contested election
season.
Does he have a mandate? What are we seeing?
So what we'll be seeing here is Brian Kemp coming in to the governorship at a time where kind of all bets are off, and it's kind of the wild, wild west in a sense that you have new leadership at the top. You have different leadership in the House and the Senate and different compositions of Democrats versus Republicans. You have questions about Georgia's voting systems and voting machines. You have a governor that has touted rural policies in rural Georgia. And so I think what you'll see is a lot of people waiting with bated breath to kind of see how it all shakes out, because allegiances may be a little uneasy, uncertain, and we'll figure out what Brian Kemp is going to bring to the table and what the legislature is going to decide to bring to the table. And so it's a interesting time for all of these elected officials to be coming together and starting this session.
Well, I definitely want to dig into that, but let's look at some of the big picture things. He's already announced the staff members who are going to be supporting him in the executive branch. Any names jump out at you as being really significant?
That's really kind of an inside baseball thing. He's certainly going to be working with people who he has either worked with extensively in the past or whose political philosophies align with him. I will say, you know, from the point of view of reporters, and Stephen can weigh in on this, and he'll have an even better sense of this than I do, the relationship that a governor or anyone in that position as CEO of an organization, that the governor can establish with us in the media, the ability to work in a positive way with us, especially in times when the president of the United States has drawn so much attention to the fake news,
the enemy of
to
the people.
Demonizing right. The media. He's announced that Cody Hall is going to be his press secretary. And throughout the campaign, Cody was the press secretary in the campaign. And from the very beginning, he established himself as a guy who was really open to dealing in the most positive right. way possible with media, even at times when Brian Kemp himself didn't share that philosophy. And so I considered it a good sign that Cody is going to be in that job just because, again, this is selfish, but we in the media are going to want to have an open channel of communication with the governor's office.
And you're right. You know, Cody Hall and I actually know each other from high school. We went to a honors program together. So Cody's a young guy, and he was always great during the campaign at being responsive. And even when, you know, he didn't like some of the questions that I ask or that other people ask, he was always there to make sure that they were answered. So that, and then Kemp announcing that Candace Brose is his communications director. Candace was the spokesperson and deputy counsel for the Secretary of State's office. So she worked for him and with him. And through all of these fiascos of the voting machines and voting rights and things like that, she was somebody there, you know, handling the PR response and dealing with the media. So to me, those two hires, as a reporter and as somebody who's got a lot of questions about the government and how the governor is going to do things, those two people being in those positions gives me a good sign that Governor Kemp is going to have a good relationship with the media, even with tough questions coming.
Well, how about for voters? If he's carrying over people who have been his colleagues during a pretty controversial campaign and the fact that he was Secretary of State during the election, how about winning over Abrams supporters and keeping up the big conversations about diversity in Georgia's leadership that took place during the election? Is Kemp seeking out women and people of color for executive branch roles?
Well, he's only announced the beginning of all this. I mean, his staff is going to be, yes, there are women on the staff that he has appointed to key positions, Candace being one of them. We're going to watch how he develops his leadership team in the legislature. Stephen, he's already announced his floor leader and a few other people on that. So I don't have that list in front of me right now. But, you know, mostly the legislative leaders are the ones that matter to the public. The inside baseball folks who work in the governor's office, the chief of staff, for instance, sure, they'll help shape policy. But their role in many ways has a much bigger impact in terms of how the people, whether they're legislators or people coming to do business with the governor, how they interact with the governor. Chiefs of staff can be really thorny individuals in state government, and legislators are often really wary of the kind of power they themselves exercise and how they do it. If you go back, say, to when Roy Barnes was governor in Georgia, right around the turn into the 21st century, he had a chief of staff. His job was to round up legislators to do what the governor wanted. He could be tough. He could be punishing if you didn't do what the governor wanted. I think people would say that Chris Riley, Nathan Deal's chief of staff, has at times been very protective of his boss. So in many ways, those kinds of roles really have a bigger impact on the people who have to deal with the governor day in and day out than they do on the public.
On this inauguration day and the first day of the legislative session, we are drawing from the deep well of experience of Bill Nygut and Stephen Fowler here at GPB, getting a little bit of a look forward to what we can expect and how are the politics are going to play out in this new Brian Kemp administration. Just want to dig into a couple of Nathan Deal legacy items. Criminal justice was a big banner of his administration. I would say maybe one of the most enduring legacies. Another thing, Kemp is coming in with a $2.5 billion rainy day fund. Has he made any suggestions of a need to cut into that? For example, his proposed education raise for teachers,
no,
raise for teachers.
No. He's not going to talk about the rainy day fund anytime
soon. Can they use it?
Yes. But remember that Nathan Deal took office when, just as the economy had turned south, things were really, we were in trouble in this state, as were states across the country. And he carefully and methodically, and it's one of the reasons I think he is such a popular figure today, just one of the reasons, carefully and methodically helped rebuild the economy here and squirreled away that enormous rainy day fund. I mean, to have more than $2 billion in that fund is a remarkable thing. And he will argue with every breath he has against tapping into that fund unless it becomes absolutely necessary, because we know that there may be a recession coming. At least some economists are predicting that. We already have signs down at the Capitol that we may see caution in the revenue estimate that the governor sets, how much growth he thinks we're really going to have, how much money we're going to have to put in the budget, because we don't know if the economy is going to go south a little bit here. And that rainy day fund has got to be there for the time being.
Right. And one of the interesting things that will come in the first few weeks here, Virginia, will be the governor's budget. And because a lot of Kemp's campaign promises have been centered around kind of tweaking the budget and making cuts here and cuts there and adding things like that increase in teacher pay. So one of the big questions that will come in the first few months that we'll see whether it gets answered or not is, where is this money coming from? Who is going to pay for it? And how is the money going to shake out in the state of Georgia? Now, speaking about Governor Deal's legacy, you know, there is a pretty big physical reminder of the criminal justice reforms coming across the street, basically from the front steps of the Capitol. And that's that new judicial complex that will most likely bear Governor Deal's name. So both candidates on the campaign trail, Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp, mentioned Nathan Deal's criminal justice reforms. Federal leaders have looked to Georgia for some of the reforms and how to fix things. And so I think Brian Kemp has mentioned on the campaign trail that he would like to continue that and continue sentencing reforms and other things like that. So certainly that would be a cornerstone issue that during his first year, if not his first 4 years, Kemp is going to continue.
You know, you mentioned how the Stacey Abrams supporters out there, Democrats in the legislature themselves, how are they going to be able to start working compatibly with a governor who ran a pretty harsh campaign against their candidate, mm-hmm. Stacey Abrams, who was surrounded by questions about election integrity and that sort of thing? So how are they going to be able to all work together? And one of the big questions has been, who will Brian Kemp be as a governor? He promoted a lot of very, very conservative issues on the campaign trail. Is that the way he's going to govern? And here's another way in which you can go back and look at Nathan Deal. When Nathan Deal was elected governor, remember, first of all, he had been a Democrat in the state legislature, right, became a Republican. And when he went to Congress, he really became part of that very conservative Republican caucus in Congress. And so there were questions as to how far to the right he might govern. I would argue that there were things he did early in his tenure, in his first term as governor, that showed that he was going to be a very conservative governor. He passed a series of bills that were very punishing to the undocumented immigrants, mm-hmm. in Georgia. And yet he moved to a more centrist point of view, passed all of the criminal justice reform, and showed people that he truly cared about the state more than he did about an ideology. I would suggest that that's a legacy that Brian Kemp has to guide him should he choose to go that way.
Well, Nathan Deal did certainly play to his conservative base in many aspects, but many of them remember him for vetoing the religious liberty deal.
Religious liberty? He vetoed the first version of campus carry, guns on campuses. So Kemp has the opportunity to show us that he, too, is going to govern not as an ideologue, but as someone who has the broader concerns of the state at heart.
We've been talking about Inauguration Day in Georgia with GPB politics reporter Stephen Fowler and Political Rewind host Bill Nigut. And after the break, they're going to stay with us, and we hope that you do too. We'll be talking about the first day of the legislative session. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is On Second Thought. Stick around. We're back with On Second Thought and Stephen Fowler and Bill Nigut from GPB. Governor-elect Brian Kemp is being inaugurated today. And amid all the pomp and circumstance, the Georgia General Assembly will also convene for the 2019 legislative session. So we're getting a preview of these important events and some 40 days of lawmaking to come. But first, Stephen, I want to go back to Kemp is not the only person, of course, taking office today. The lieutenant governor's race, of course, got a little lost in the election for governor. But it's also a big role in Georgia. The person leads the state Senate. So what do you think Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan has in mind for that chamber?
Well, if you look back to the last session, you see the power that the lieutenant governor could wield when Casey Cagle threatened a tax break for Delta and other airlines because of a partnership deal that they ended with the National Rifle Association. But what you see this Senate, or what you don't necessarily see on the surface, is that Jeff Duncan was not the favored candidate. He was not the favored Republican candidate. That was David Schaefer. So many alliances and allegiances in the Senate were resting on David Schaefer becoming the lieutenant governor and previous lieutenant governor Casey Cagle becoming governor. So Jeff Duncan came from the House, so he has no Senate experience, and he wasn't the favored candidate. So what you're going to have to see is a little bit of a alliance shifting there and kind of proving to the members of that legislative body that he has the leadership capability and the leadership power and that he can work with Brian Kemp to kind of get the agenda done. So
yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, they're kind of an exclusive club over there in the state Senate. They like their own folks.
Well, and a lot of them supported Casey Cagle in his race.
Yes, they did. And so to have a member of the House come over and be their new leader, you know, we do have history in this state where the Republicans in control of the legislature have essentially stripped the lieutenant governor of some of his powers because they chose to take on the powers themselves. And you can do that in the Senate in a way you could never get away with. You can't do that in the House of Representatives in a similar way.
Georgia is, of course, getting a new Secretary of State today who will replace Brian Kemp in that role, and voter access, a huge issue, and the method of voting and voter machines. Now, Bill, you had Brad Raffensperger on your show just after the election. What has he said about what will be on his agenda or focus?
Well, Raffensperger's number one obligation is going to be to guide the state as they move into an era where they're being required to bring in new voting machines. Brian Kemp, as Secretary of State, impaneled the commission that's been looking at alternative means to vote. And it strikes me, Stephen, that that's going to be one of the most important things he does. First is to help move a bill that will establish what machines we're going to use. But then he's going to have to deal with how he fits in to this entire election reform piece that any number of legislators feel we better do after this 2018 election.
And, you know, I've talked with Raffensperger as well. I interviewed him just before the new year. I talked with him at the SAFE Commission voting machine demonstration a few weeks ago, and he says he's bringing kind of an administrative mindset to the Secretary of State's office and the Secretary of State's position. It's a partisan position where it's either Republican or Democrat that holds it, but he says he's viewing it in this kind of nonpartisan way of streamlining voting and streamlining some of the other responsibilities that the Secretary of State's office has, like licensing and business corporation filings and things like that. He told me that he wants to do his job so well that nobody knows what he's doing, because things run so smoothly.
Well, he is, of course, critical in this role. But how about, you've been covering these efforts to reform Georgia's voting system. Does it look like lawmakers are going to be able to hit the ground running on this issue? Is there enough information to make decisions now?
Well, the final meeting of the SAFE Commission was last Thursday. They've heard from experts and voters and activists and advocates for all sorts of different things. And they've gotten to play with the machines and touch the machines and try them out and ask questions. So now it will be up to the legislators to take that information that the commission had, listen to the voters, listen to the county elections officials, and craft some sort of bill that would allow new machines and a new system to be put in place. But they'll also have to reform the state's election code, because a lot of the code is centered around using a direct recording electronic machine. So this is not something that's going to be done on the first day. They take it up for a vote and then sign it along and then pass it along to Brian Kemp to sign. This is going to take hashing out, and there's a lot of questions around how voting works, even from members of the commission who are lawmakers that have been researching this.
And they don't have much time.
40 days.
Well, yes, they have 40 days in the session, but also we're only a little more than a year away from Georgia having a primary election for the presidential race. So they're going to have to move because a year to put new machines in place and to educate voters as well as election officials in counties across the state is not a lot of time.
And Bill, to that point, this gets into a little bit of the metagame around what's going to be a legislative priority. If you're looking at this, if you're Brian Kemp, maybe you don't try to do something like a religious freedom bill or some sort of other socially conservative bill because it takes away from the time and it takes away from the goodwill to get something important like this passed.
That's GPB Politics reporter Stephen Fowler. Also with me, Bill Nygut, host of Political Rewind. We're getting a sense of what's ahead today. It's Inauguration Day, and also lawmakers are meeting today for the next session for the first time. And among them, this was 2018, certainly ended up being the year of the woman for Georgia state leadership. Record number of women will be in power in our state, although they still make up just 31% of legislators, but up from 25% in 2017. Does it look like these women are going to be bringing change to Georgia?
So here's one of the ways in which I think the impact of women will be felt. This is going to be a big year for healthcare under the Gold Dome. We know that there's going to be talk more, as there has been for a while now, about Medicaid expansion, but it'll be back again in a big way. There's talk about rural healthcare. There's going to be talk about a medical marijuana bill that would allow for production of cannabinoid oil in the state of Georgia. And you know what? It seems to me, and this is obviously completely subjective, that women have a better handle often on the kinds of issues that relate directly to health than men do. I'll cite as an example of that the fact that the legislator who has done more at leading in terms of health issues in the past few sessions is a woman, Renee Unterman, a senator from Gwinnett County. And I do think that women have a certain kind of credibility when it comes to those sorts of issues that might be felt in a big way and feel more passionate about those issues. Does that make sense?
Well, I'm just guessing that you're going to get some guff from listeners about that, saying that women...
Well, you know, here's the problem with that. You're right. I mean, I asked on our show not long ago whether it was sexist to believe that women somehow might play a different role than men would when they in the U.S. House or in the Georgia legislature. And I get it. There are people who push back and say, well, why do you think women are different than men? But the fact is that in many cases, women do have agendas and issues that are not necessarily the same as the men around them. Bring on the fight, listeners.
And if the line is that for too long, you know, white old men have been in power, we're bringing something different, there is a real difference there. But I want to get to that. Healthcare is an issue, of course. Speaker Ralston is going to have a big challenge on his hand. All the legislators reforming it, just one part of the challenge. So what do you think Ralston is going to focus on? We've got lack of rural physicians and hospitals, Medicaid expansions, waivers, the opioid crisis. Any indication there?
Well, Ralston has announced a panel of lawmakers to kind of take on the mantle of health care. It's a step beyond the House Rural Development Council that has been meeting to figure out ways to help rural Georgia and parts of the state that are often neglected in these legislative conversations. And so I think that rural health care angle is going to be huge. Brian Kemp won on a rural-based campaign and with backing from much of rural Georgia. And so I think this time you're going to see a lot of the legislative priorities come from places outside of Metro Atlanta or Macon or Augusta or Columbus and kind of shape the way of making sure that the rest of the state gets the same sort of attention and legislative remedy that places like Atlanta do.
Well, we have seen from our national lawmakers that it takes a lot of power and a lot of agreement to get things done. Are there any particular issues that Kemp, Duncan, and Ralston are seemingly aligned on or working towards some sort of bipartisan resolution for Georgia?
I think it's quite possible that there might be some bipartisan support for an expansion of how medical marijuana is delivered in the state. It's possible that people could come together around that issue. I think that it's going to be interesting to see. Democrats and Republicans are going to have different approaches to how aggressive they want election reform legislation to be. Democrats are going to want a lot more, for instance, than Republicans do. Exact match, for instance, which was a huge issue in the 2018 cycle. Democrats are going to want to eliminate it entirely. Republicans won't want to eliminate it, I don't imagine. But I got to think that given the black eye that Georgia has gotten nationally over our election issues, that there might be some modest changes in election law that Republicans and Democrats can agree on.
There are plenty of issues that both Democrats and Republicans feel strongly about, not limited to election reform, new voting machines, health care, and job opportunities for rural Georgia. And I think that's something that you'll see both parties come together on. It's just a matter of what flavor of compromise.
Yeah, I'll tell you another issue that I think we might see bipartisanship on. Brian Kemp made a very bold commitment during his campaign, $5,000 raise for every public school teacher in the state of Georgia, K through 12. That's a lot of money.
Like $600 million by some estimates.
Yeah, more than that. I think you could very easily get bipartisan support for the fact that Georgia teachers deserve raises. I'm not sure you can do it in 1 year, but over a couple of years, I think that it would be hard for Democrats to fight that, or even very conservative Republicans.
Republicans do control all three branches of government in Georgia once again. It seems like a recipe for getting a lot of stuff done. Let's look at the year that we've had in Congress. So any chances that Georgia is going to have gridlock this session on particular issues?
Well, I think there's definitely going to be some sort of gridlock. This is the legislature, after all, and you've got lawmakers from all corners of the state with all types of different constituencies and wants and needs and perspectives on things. But what you'll see this year is, you know, maybe some of those key hallmark issues, but it's the other little things that get added in on the side or that, you know, take up committee debates or other things like that, that you may see some sort of gridlock, because what a lawmaker in Metro Atlanta may want to do is a little bit different than what somebody may want to do on the coast. And there are different perspectives on these issues that you'll see some sort of disagreement about how to get things. And even with these bipartisan issues like voting machine reforms, to get several hundred people to agree on an exact formula for how something should and should not happen, even if you take the partisan lens out of it, there's going to be some sort of disagreements on whether Georgia should use number two pencils or number three pencils. And so I think there's going to be still some degree of gridlock, but the overall big picture, there's going to be some compromises.
But you know, I think gridlock in Georgia's legislature doesn't resemble gridlock in Washington. Gridlock in the Georgia legislature is what the House wants, the Republican House, and what the Republican Senate wants. It isn't about parties. It's how the power centers of each body fight one another to get what they want. For instance, as a great example of that, it has been the Senate for years that has always fairly quickly passed a religious liberty bill out. The House won't do it. David Ralston has said, we're not going to pass a religious liberty bill. That's gridlock, but it's not partisan gridlock. It's just a different kind of gridlock.
Well, so we're getting a Georgia civics lesson, a Georgia How Stuff Works lesson, a little bit of history. And Stephen, this is something that you're going to be tracking, How Stuff Works, let's say. Tell us about this Peach State Politics series that you're going to start online.
Well, sure. So I have just started a new GPB education digital mini-series called Peach State Politics. In Georgia, eighth grade students have Georgia Studies, which is a class that teaches them all about Georgia's history and government politics and things. So once a week during the legislative session, I'm going to be answering questions from Georgia Studies students or adult learners like the listeners of On Second Thought, kind of explaining just how different parts of the government works. It'll be my first time down at the state capitol covering the legislature, so I've got a lot of questions, so why not, you know, multiple heads are better than one. So look out for these once a week videos explaining how different things work, like who pays for all the bills, who gets to write the legal language, and why is there a two-headed snake in the corner of the Capitol?
I'm guessing it's more than just eighth graders who are mystified by all of those things. Well, you love politics. Our listeners love your reporting. What are you looking most forward to as new lawmakers come into power and get to work 2019?
This is a new era in Georgia politics of sorts. It's the post-Stacey Abrams-Brian Kemp election era, where you've got energized Democrats looking to 2020. You've got energized Republicans looking to capitalize on a more rural-centric legislature and a more rural-centric governor. And so there's a lot of opportunities for Georgia to make a lot of changes, including a new voting system. And so there are a lot of things about Georgia that will be evolving over the next few years. And each piece of the puzzle, the governor, the legislature, the voters, have a role to play. And so it'll be interesting and exciting to see how Georgia evolves in the coming years.
How about for you, Bill?
Well, I'm starting to look toward 2020. So I'm really interested in looking at who's going to challenge David Perdue from the Democratic Party, which candidates are going to emerge to take on Perdue. But I'm also looking at the conventional wisdom is now Georgia is going to be in play in the 2020 presidential race. Mm-hmm. Presidential politics has begun, whether you like it or not. It's happening out there. And I'm really looking forward to seeing whether those predictions that candidates are going to have to, for the first time in decades, really pay attention to Georgia. If they do, it's going to be exciting to be in Georgia for the first time in quite a while to watch a presidential campaign and actually have candidates come to this state and engage us. That's going to be really fun to watch.
I predict it'll be play out very well on Political Rewind. Thank you so much for speaking with
us. Thanks, Virginia.
And Stephen Fowler, thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Nygut, of course, host of Political Rewind on GPB and GPB TV. And Stephen Fowler, he's our GPB politics reporter, telling us about Brian Kemp's gubernatorial inauguration today and so much more with the opening of the legislative session. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we got a rundown of some of the things facing Brian Kemp when he is sworn in later today at Georgia Tech's McCamish Pavilion. Now to more on the legacy of Governor Nathan Deal, whose eight-year tenure as governor is ending. Governor Deal has had his critics, certainly, but has also earned praise for initiatives related to business, education, and criminal justice reform especially. Many of these achievements are symbolically represented in his portrait with Georgia's First Lady, Sandra Deal, which will now hang at the state capitol. James Salzer covers state government and politics for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he's with us to talk about Deal's legacy. Welcome, James.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Also with us, Maria Saporta. She's founder of the Saporta Report and contributor to the Atlanta Business Chronicle. Maria, thank you so much for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
All right, let's take a look back. 8 years ago, the fog of 8 years ago, early days of the Great Recession, certainly deepening political divides here and across the nation. James, what kind of climate did Governor Deal inherit when he took office?
He walked into, to put it mildly, a mess financially. The state was still recovering from the Great Recession. Teachers were still being furloughed in a number of counties. State employees were still being furloughed. Education particularly was hard hit by the recession, and there had been a lot of cutbacks. He also came into a situation where there was virtually no room for error because the state had spent down reserves to $100 million, roughly. $100 million sounds like a lot of money, but it's actually only one day's what it costs for one day for the state government to run. One of his big platform items in 2010, obviously, was jobs, which made sense because the unemployment rate was very high.
It was over 10%.
Right,
when he
right,
came in.
Right. So for the state, it had been the second recession in like 6 or 7 years. Governor Perdue had gone through two of them in his 8 years. Financially, we were way down from what we had been in 2008 in terms of what we were spending on various state programs.
So, Maria, let's look at economic recovery. Things did, of course, eventually turn around for the nation and the state. So was this a case of the rising tide lifting all boats, or did Deal spearhead particular policies that made that transformation easier in Georgia?
Well, back to the situation he encountered. The Great Recession was especially hard on the banking industry and on the real estate industry, which were two areas of focus in Georgia. Deal became really systematic, not wanting to spend a lot of the state's money, but kind of build within a budget that existed, and focused on some high growth areas, and the film industry and the film tax credit is one such example.
So tremendous growth in the film industry, certainly technology, manufacturing, even at a time when it was not having a robust growth in the country, a couple of industries that have seen expansion. So did his policy show support for any particular areas of the economy?
Well, I think what he was looking at is, what did business need? How do you develop or prepare a workforce to serve industry? He realized early on that there were jobs to be had, just the skill set wasn't there to fulfill those jobs. So he tried to bridge the people who are unemployed to give them the skill sets so that they could actually fill some of the jobs that Georgia companies needed to fill. He also has been, you know, very proactive when it comes to economic development. He made that a key priority, and you saw the results of that with Georgia being named the number one state to do business by Site Selection magazine for 6 years in a row, and a lot of great economic development successes, a lot of companies picking us.
On social issues, he's also, it seems like he has been very cognizant of the state's image and what is good for business in other ways. For instance, last week, Speaker David Ralston described, for instance, religious liberty legislation as a solution looking for a problem. And that's kind of the way Governor Deal has dealt with a number of social issues that, if it's a possibility that it's going to hurt Georgia business, he's probably going to avoid it.
Let's go to that. The 2016 Religious Liberty Bill started out as a conflict between some conservative Christians and LGBTQ advocates. But Deal did veto it, and that was after it threatened some businesses in Georgia. Do you want to pick that up, Maria?
Yeah, that was the moment of truth in my mind. He could have gone either way. He clearly was getting pressured by both sides. I think that when he made the decision to veto that legislation, it sent a signal that Georgia was not going to go down the road that North Carolina or some other states had gone, and that we were going to really be sensitive to business concerns, issues of discrimination. Immigration was not as big an issue there, but I think Deal has used the lens. Is this going to help us in attracting business, or is it going to hurt us? And that's been a really healthy lens for our state.
Well, let's hear a little bit from his speech after vetoing that bill.
I do not think that we have to discriminate against anyone to protect the faith-based community in Georgia, of which I and my family have been a part of for all of our lives. Georgia is a welcoming state. It is full of loving, kind, and generous people.
Significant because, you know, this is a governor that came in. He was originally a Democrat when he entered the state Senate.
Yes.
But, of course, ran as a Republican for governor. When I look at his legacy as an outsider, you know, someone who didn't live here during that time, seeing that he throws a lot of red meat to his conservative base in some places, you know, obviously gun rights legislation, a fiscal policy, certainly, but not necessarily a predictable line. So where do you see him as somebody who ran from as a Republican who kind of governs from the middle? Is that a correct assessment?
You have to look at it also politically. And I remember talking to someone close to him a few weeks ago, and I said, I wonder if Governor Deal of 2010 could win the Republican nomination in 2018, and I kind of doubt it.
Interesting point. So he's not conservative enough now for the Georgia.
I don't see him, having ads with guns or, you know, talking about. I mean, maybe he would have. His policies don't go along with maybe the skew closer to Trumpian.
in that same time, Georgia has become increasingly, let's say, purple in places, blue in other spots, not so much a solid red state. So is the key for his success then, is it the electoral body or is it the way that he worked with the legislature to get things passed?
I've covered governors getting back to Joe Frank Harris, and I can't remember a governor who had the same kind of working relationship with the legislature. One of the things I spent a lot of time on is a budget, and his team would negotiate very openly with the House and Senate leaders while it was going on. And at the end of the day, they'd reach an agreement, and there really wouldn't be a whole lot of fight over what the state spent money on. They kind of decided, and he let the legislature play a role in that in a way that other governors haven't.
The way I would describe him is being a very practical leader. That relationship that was definitely got a lot of press of his friendship with former Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed, having a Democrat in the mayor's office, a Republican as governor. They took it on the road. They made it a national, shtick to show, hey, in Georgia, we can really make things work in a bipartisan way. That sent a message to companies, to businesses, to governments. And again, I saw it as a relationship that was one that came out of practicality. Deal didn't have a lot of good contacts in the Obama administration, and having a close relationship with Mayor Reed, they were able to get that attention. And I think they both benefited from being able to work together across party lines.
He also made criminal justice reform a hallmark of his administration, not something that was certainly a frontline issue for a lot of Republicans, let's say nationally. Why do you think that was a focus for Governor Deal? And why do you think he was so successful?
I think he looked back at his history. He was a judge. His son is a judge. He has seen the criminal justice system up close. And I think this was a very personal issue with him.
Yeah. And throughout the last several months, almost every time he talked about criminal justice reform, he brought people's names into the storyline and talked about the people who either worked at the governor's mansion or people that he met who said how their lives had been changed because of the courts that had been established. And inevitably, tears would come to his eyes, and his voice would start quivering, and he'd have to stop, or otherwise he'd really start crying. I think there's nothing that reached deeper to his heart than criminal justice reform.
That's Maria Saporta. She's founder of the Saporta Report, a contributor to the Atlanta Business Chronicle. Yeah. James Salzer is also with us. He covers state government and politics for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and has been for some time. So, James, as you look back over the Deal legacy, one of the most lasting impacts has been or will be on the state is judicial system. Convinced state lawmakers to expand the Supreme Court, enabling him to appoint most of the current court. He expanded the appellate court, appointed his protege Chris Carr, attorney general, new solicitor general. So what does this mean? What are the ramifications for the state of Georgia to have the head of the executive branch so significantly reshape judicial?
And you left out, he pushed major pay raises for the judges, and he appointed some of the people he appointed, as you mentioned, Chris Carr, but he also appointed legislators to some of these positions. So he opened up legislative positions. So there's a whole domino effect on Governor Deal setting the agenda. He also pushed and won approval for the most expensive building in the state, which is the state court building that's going up down the street from the Capitol. I think it's $115 or $120 million is what it's going to cost. And if you drive by the Capitol area, you'll see it going up.
It's going to be named after him.
And it's going to be there's already legislation that's going to name it after him. This is like kind of a dream for I know a lot of people who vote one party or the other because they say they want to see, they want to make sure their person is appointing the Supreme Court, right? So this is kind of a similar thing. I mean, he not only got to, don't use the word negatively, pack the court with the people that he wants. And a lot of these people he's appointing are as I can say as an older person, fairly young, and so will be there for many, many, many years. So his legacy will live on, certainly in the legal community.
Well, how about the idea of packing? I mean, he made dozens and dozens of other appointments during his tenure. State lawmakers convinced voters to pass an amendment that reshapes the Judicial Qualifications Commission. Critics said that was payback. After the watchdog group, Judicial Qualifications Commission, hit too close to home with some of the lawmakers. Yep. So I'm wondering from either of you, what does it mean for balance of power in Georgia that the executive, legislative, so have such a tight grip on the third branch of government?
Well, one thing that did disappoint me is a lot of his appointments tended to be white males and white male Republicans. I think there was an opportunity for him to bring a lot more diversity to state boards than he did. One of the problems Georgia always seems to have is that good old boy network, especially now that every one of the constitutional offices are white male Republicans.
When you put the lineup of the Democrats who are running for statewide offices and you put the Republicans running, you know, other than Tricia Pridemore, who's on the PSC, there were no statewide nominees who weren't white men.
Both of you mentioned Governor Deal and education, and certainly Sandra Deal, the first lady, had a huge impact and push, a former teacher herself. What, if you were to summarize it, was his legacy in the educational realm?
He kind of ran on education in his second term, and the things he specifically talked about didn't pan out. I mean, he talked about wanting to rewrite the state's school funding formula, which was created before I got here in the 80s, mid-80s. And he ran in the same buzzsaw every governor who's ever tried this has run into, that there's so many competing interests. Inevitably had to cost more money, and they didn't want to spend more money. I mean, I think they said it right up front: we're going to redo the school funding formula without spending any more money, and that was going to be kind of a non-starter. Last year, he had the money for the first time to fully fund the school funding formula since before Sonny Perdue's first recession. So that was roundly applauded because that had been something that educators had complained about forever, that the state wasn't actually putting in as much money as it was supposed to be for schools.
And he was definitely aided by First Lady Sandra Deal. I mean, she was loved by the education community. She went and she would read to first graders in every county in Georgia. I think she had gone to 1,000 different schools by the end of his term. And literacy was just a huge issue. And I think that if Governor Deal had been reelected for a third term, which obviously is against the law, I think that would have been a major area of focus for him.
Maria, I'm hearing a big fan of Governor Deal in you.
Let me put it to you this way. My expectations were quite low when he first ran. He had been labeled the most corrupt congressman before he ran, and I had a lot of trepidation about what kind of governor he would become. And I have to say, in many areas, I was very pleasantly surprised. I wish we had been able to make more headway on the whole Medicaid expansion issue. He basically punted that to the legislature that basically killed it. I wish he had been stronger on some gun carry legislation in terms of limiting that. I think he did have to throw a few bones to the conservative base. But overall, I think he was a governor that did not govern in a partisan way, but really looking at what was best for the state of Georgia.
You already mentioned, Maria, that he can get weepy when he's telling his stories. I think he's admitted he's a sap himself.
Yep.
What are the bets he's going to cry today?
1,000%.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. James Salzer covers state government and politics for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Maria Saporta. She's founder of The Saporta Report and contributor to the Atlanta Business Chronicle. Happy Inauguration Day.
Thank you. Yeah, back to you.
On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Tyler Morris is our engineer. Amy Kiley is senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with GPB today for live coverage of the inauguration, including a special early edition of Political Rewind coming up at 1.